I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Jason Blakely, Associate Professor of Political Science at Pepperdine University. We're discussing his recent book, Lost in Ideology, Interpreting Modern Political Life, from Agenda Publishing. Blakely's research is on communitarianism, post-liberal thought, and the philosophy of the social sciences. He is the author most recently of Rebuilt Reality from Oxford University Press, as well as many articles in academic and popular journals. Okay, well, first of all, Jason Blakely, welcome back to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I've listened to the podcast for years, and I love being on.
Great. Well, Jason, I love this book, so thanks for writing it and agreeing to be on it to talk to me about it. It's a great analysis of, sweeping kind of analysis of modern political ideologies, and I hope to try to get to as many as we can. Can you first start up by telling us a little bit about what motivated you to write the book?
Yeah, I guess the mess we're in, it's one of these cases where I sort of hoped that, as Wittgenstein, famously says, that philosophy might show the flies the way out of the fly bottle. I felt like we're stuck, lay people and theorists alike, in an age of incredible ideological bewilderment and movement, and myself too. I mean, 2016 is the year you can kind of hang it on, but stuff started to move really fast. For those of us who grew up in the 80s and 90s, it seemed like the rate of change and the unexpected things that happened in ideology just so I was trying to get my bearings as well while I was writing this book.
So the book's about ideologies. I mean, simple question to start out with, but this might occupy us for a few minutes. But what is ideology? What do you mean by it?
Yeah, it's one of these terms that, as Augustine says, about time, everyone knows what it is as long as you don't ask them, what it is. Everyone uses it. And the book sort of starts out a little bit polemically with the notion that ideology is basically used reductively as a pejorative, like politics in excess or distorted political beliefs. And I see myself as working within a tradition of hermeneutics and interpretivism that my other work comes out of as well. And within that tradition, there's already a basis to think of ideologies as having positive cognitive content as well as negative. And so you have to sort of work through ideologies dialectically. So I'm really inspired by, first and foremost, people like Charles Taylor and his hermeneutics. And I'm trying to offer sort of phenomenology of ideology, but also, people like Clifford Geertz, and his definition of ideology, which we could get into. But I was trying to give an account of ideology that isn't just name calling or already absorbed within one of the ideological traditions. Because often when it becomes pejorative, it starts to be marked clearly by being within someone's ideology still, the term ideology itself. So that can't do very much work for you as a political theorist unless you're just going to stay within a particular ideological tradition.
Yeah, when I think about ideology, I think of like two different traditions of thinking about it, which both of which you don't mean. So maybe you could just sharpen your own hermeneutic approach in contrast to these. So one tradition is, I guess, you could say the sort of general sociological way in which the social science way we use ideology, which is a sort of value neutral, whatever people believe, their set of beliefs that we can sort of identify that would be over and against the sort of set of preferences or their emotions or something like that. It's a sort of social scientific variable. But the other way, I think, is like the Marxist tradition, which has very different valence. It's sort of like normatively laden. And it has to do with the way in which belief systems sort of entrench a certain power structure, right? So you believe in natural rights or something because you're an oligarch and want to hold on to your stuff. How do you see your hermeneutic approach to ideology sort of differing from those usual ones?
That's really helpful, and actually I had a ton of stuff in the introduction that the publisher asked me to kick to the back of the book, and then some of it cut out, and they were right for sort of for the nature of this book. Actually, I think it was a good edit, but it was on these very issues, that it is this cultural, hermeneutic, phenomenological approach to ideology is in conflict with the major other approaches. And you put two of them out there very nicely. And I think that what I was trying to do was offer, unlike the Marxist account in which the way I would sort of put it, echoing Paul Ricoeur, is, you know, well, you know, I have a theory, you have an ideology, you know, like ideology is someone else's problem. It's their rationalization of their power structures. It's that, whereas Marxism is somehow what? Science, or, you know, we're talking orthodox Marxism here. I appreciate there could be the risk of caricature here, and I'm not trying to do that. But, you know, one of the basic problems in the book is the idea that when you don't adopt the right conception of ideology, you become lost in ideology because you assume that you yourself aren't working within an ideological tradition. You're outside of it. You're somehow within a mere science of ideas or common sense or just practical reasoning. So on one side, yes, I wanted to offer a theory of ideology that resisted that sort of reductive account of ideology as epiphenomenal or, you know, post hoc rationalization of some kind. And yeah, you're rightly seeing that another beef I have there, even though I don't state it in the book until I think the end, is with empiricism. Because in political science, ideology tends to be treated as a variable sometimes through party identification or, you know, beliefs that correlate with voter behavior. And so ideology gets kind of atomized in a way that doesn't match self-understanding. So, you know, in the phenomenological tradition, it's very important to capture the what it's like to have something, you know, hence the first person perspective. And something I'm trying to do in the book that's really hard, and I keep expecting chapter by chapter for the different partisans of different ideologies to say I didn't get it quite right, which would be a fair criticism, is I tried to capture the what it's like to have an ideology. And something I think that empiricist political science doesn't get right is, even though it claims to describe ideology as a phenomenon, it doesn't actually even match. It doesn't even reach the level of description, because what it's like to hold an ideology is to perceive it as true, what I call ethically magnetic. You know, it makes truth claims. It grabs and shapes human identity and action. And so it's not at the phenomenological level. I don't think, well, I'm voting X because I have, you know, party belief Y, or it correlates with demographic feature, you know, C or D, you know. So I do try to sort of open a space there for what I think is a more philosophically defensible account of the phenomenology of ideology, of the, what it's like to have an ideology.
Great. And you mentioned a minute ago the idea of being lost in ideology, because that's, of course, the title of the main title of the book. So let me say a little bit about how we are lost in ideology. And is the idea that we're always lost in ideology, or are we becoming more lost today?
I think that we can be less lost in ideology. Back to your question about what motivated the book, and in at least, to simplify for a second, two ways. The book tries to offer a more defensible philosophical conception of ideology that we've been kind of kicking around a little bit here so far. And so that would be almost, if you want to use a metaphor, almost like a compass that you can use to navigate all the different ideologies, is my hope. But then you can also become less lost in ideology by understanding other ideologies in their own linguistic cultural terms, which is understanding those traditions as such without making any kind of like a reductive or atomizing move on them. And so that's the rest of the book, is a kind of tour of ideologies, which could be mistaken as a survey of ideology. It's not. It's sort of critical hermeneutical reconstruction of ideology from the inside out. But so that's a second way we can become less lost in ideology, is we can become what I like to call polyglots ideologically, or multilingual. That I think, but one of the reasons we're lost in ideology is we only speak one ideological language, and we surround ourselves with people who only speak that language. And so everything repeats itself back at us. And we almost are in the stupid position of someone who, I don't know, speaks English or Mandarin or Spanish, and just expects everyone else to speak the same language. I have a family member who I won't out, but he traveled to Havana, and he was much older, so to be fair with him. But every time he would approach someone, he would just speak to them in English. You know, he couldn't help it. And it, someone kept having to correct him and say, they don't speak English here, you know? And I actually think we're all a little like that with our ideologies. It's like, you know, we sort of evoke our concepts almost dogmatically to the other. And so I think that's part of being deeply lost in ideology, is that you assume your language is the universal language of politics in some commonsensical or unmediated, historically, hermeneutically unmediated way. So yeah, you can become less lost in ideology, given that I think that we're always sort of moving through the fog, you know, if you like, of it.
Yes, it reminds me a little bit about the classical tradition. So maybe you can say a little bit about why you prefer the hermeneutic tradition to so the classical tradition, like, I don't know, Aristotle or Plato. Or you say Aristotle, what he does is he sort of surveys a series of opinions. The distinction they use is, say, opinion versus knowledge. So most human beings operate most of the time at the level of opinion, that is sort of unreflective appropriation of some, you know, set of beliefs about the moral and political world. Socrates famously sort of interrogates these opinions and shows them to not be based on knowledge. But, you know, so the it's a kind of ascent from opinion to knowledge, portrayed memorably in Plato's Republic. This is kind of what I start my intro to political theory class with, is the allegory of the cave. I take it, though, the hermeneutic, you know, that, I mean, just remember my Gadamer, right? So it's not, yes, about escaping from a cave, because you can't escape from a cave, but some kind of fusion of horizons, perhaps. So anyway, maybe say a little bit about, you know, that classical tradition, the ways in which classical tradition would sort of get us to escape ideology, to make us not lost in it, and why the hermeneutic approach kind of is the preferable way to go to think about this.
Yeah, I think of my hermeneutics as coming via Gadamer and particularly Charles Taylor, as I mentioned. And so I think of them as neo-Aristotelian. So in a way, and so the question for me around what you're calling the classical tradition would be, what parts of it does one identify as, you know, helpful still, and what parts does one have to overcome? You know, for instance, when I think I mention it in the book, but when Aristotle says the natural telos or end of the human being is the Greek polis, you know, to me, that's like a classic case of sort of not having self-knowledge. On the other hand, there's some basic insights that Aristotle has. For instance, the definition of ideology I try to offer up, well, what are its features? One feature is that ideologies are what I call ethically magnetic, or visions of a good society. They're never simply descriptions, you know, they're never simply a sort of social physics, or sometimes they present themselves that way. Think of like a certain branch of sort of hardline, you know, free market economics or orthodox Marxism, or, you know, there are different ways in which ideologies can try to present themselves as a sort of science. But one of the claims of hermeneutics that draws on Aristotle, and you can see that already there in the Ethics and the Politics, is the idea that human life is always inevitably structured around some either explicit or tacit sense of what's good, or highest good, or a ranking of goods. And my account of ideology still fits in that sense, I think, with Aristotle's notion that we're a political animal, in the sense that we have to assume some notion of the highest good. And I think that one of the things that, say, the sort of reductive account of ideology that we're talking about before, where it's just false rationalizations, gets wrong, is it doesn't see that the human situation is one in which we have rival claimants to a vision of what's good in society. And in that sense, I consider myself quite congenial to Aristotle and Plato. However, you're right that epistemologically, I don't think there's a kind of exit, if that's how we want to read. There's not an easy exit to sort of the forms or something like that that are inscribed, or our political forms, or however Kallipolis fits with the beautiful, the good, the true, or however we think of those. But we don't exit into sort of like the inscribed politics in the Book of Nature, in the Book of the Cosmos. Instead, we have to have the arguments over what's a better or worse account of political life from inside of history, if you like. So yeah, there's a kind of historical or interpretive turn there.
Yeah, and the I guess it's the criticism that one would wonder here about. You talk about this in the conclusion, but maybe you could just say a little bit about it, because it's, yeah, so the hermeneutic approach is sort of the sort of external transcendent approach to criticizing, you know, criticizing ideologies from the outside is sort of foreclosed because you can't really achieve a perspective from nowhere on this view. So it's more about imminent criticism,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. I mean, so maybe you could say a little bit about that and how you in the book sort of approach the kind of imminent criticism of these ideologies.
Yeah, I'm big on imminent critique, which I've come through German idealism and Hegel and things into the phenomenological tradition more generally. I think I should say one of the intellectual heroes of the book is Jorge Luis Borges, and he's the epigraph to the book, and he also gives the book its central metaphor around lostness. So, you know, if ideologies are these kind of narratives or maps of meaning that orient people towards some vision of the good on the hermeneutic or phenomenological view, then one of the ways we become lost, which gives me some critical leverage to your question, one of the ways we become lost is we mistake cartography, our map, for geography as having like a simple relationship to nature out there, whereas ideologies always emerge within history, inside of culture. But one of the things I'm trying to do all along is if our definition of ideology is that they're cultural maps and visions of the good that get articulated from inside of history, this already generates a criticism of any ideology that thinks of itself as simply being common sense or ahistorical or a science or just description. So one cluster of criticisms has to do with the very hermeneutic or interpretive approach to ideology is itself critical of certain ideologies. So I think what I try to say in the book is our theory of ideology can tell us what ideology is not, a little like the practice of negative theology in the history of Christian thought, where theologians would just say, well, God was not, God's not finite, God's not. You can do that, I think, with ideology and objectively arrive at a critical position on all the ideologies by knocking down the versions of them that can't self-narrate as cultural, historical, et cetera. I think of that as a bit of an external critique because it's coming from within hermeneutics into the different ideologies. But like you said, another set of criticisms that I think you need the art of interpretation or hermeneutics to get right is imminent critique. So you go from inside the cultural map and then you find pressure normatively, philosophically, logically, from inside the tradition itself. So that's another kind of mode of criticism that if you're just variabilizing or if you're trying to reduce it to power structures or the bourgeoisie, you're not really getting a strong imminent critique. And I think one of the reasons we're so bad at debating with each other ideologically is, and this always gets the students to sit up straight in my class, you know, everyone now on street level adopts Marx's notion of ideology as false consciousness. Everyone's very comfortable making the move of, well, you just believe that because you're a, you know, even the people on Fox News make that argument. But one of the ways that we're not having a productive, like you said, Gadamer's fusion of horizons is we're not hearing the voice of the other's ideology on its own terms enough to really land a criticism that would put any pressure on them. It all sounds like bad faith from the outside, reductive moves that, you know, you have your political beliefs, not because you have been drawn into them, find them making truth claims, ethically inspiring, but just because you are A, B, or C, that's a reductive move that's non-rational. So yeah, I think another cluster of criticisms that hermeneutics is so important for is this imminent aspect. Because if I'm really going to see what contradicts inside the framework on its own terms, I'm going to have to be patient, hermeneutically patient and generous with the other that I might think, yeah, at the end of the day is completely wrongheaded or whatever it is, even wicked or whatever we think about what they're doing, you know?
Yeah, that's good. So it made me wonder at, because we'll go through the ideologies, but just mm-hmm. as a kind of preview to think about which is the more common concern with these modern ideologies, is that they fall afoul of the kind of external criticism that they claim a kind of objective authority, a kind of scientism, that they're outside of the hermeneutic circle, or is it more common for them to be have sort of inconsistent, contradictory beliefs, or maybe they're all prey to all of them equally?
My view, and this does come out in the book, is that all ideologies have some pressure points or dilemmas internal to them, you know, and so what we don't have as human beings is the ideology that has no questions around it that can be posed philosophically or that no reasonable person could contest or doubt. On the other hand, I think there are some traditions that are far more damaged by this insight that ideologies are not just, say, like scientism or some mere empirical description of the facts. One I think that is really badly damaged is most forms of white supremacy and white nationalism, because they tend to rest, yes, bigoted, xenophobic theories are much older than the age of science. Obviously, theology can inspire it, different cultural traditions can, but modern racism is hugely informed by a kind of street level pseudoscience about genetics, about reading people's bodies. And hermeneutics does critical damage to the mainstream forms of racist ideology in a way that I think to get right by hermeneutics, anyone who is participating in that tradition would really have to revamp the ideology in a way that it's almost not recognizable in the public square. But then there are other ideologies where it's not so much the case. Like, I'm kind of hard on Marxism, but I think there are forms of socialism, or at least mainstream orthodox 20th century Marxism fell into this kind of scientism. I'm sort of hard on free market liberalism, but there's so many liberalisms that don't. I quite admire T.H. Green, for instance. I'm critical of Burke, but I sort of like Oakeshott. I'm a humanist. I'm a hermeneutic humanist. So I say by the end of the book that I'm in the position vis-a-vis ideologies. Of course, I have my own political commitments. I have the ideologies that I think more persuasive than others. But my main position in the book is as a humanist who sort of hopes to see more humanistic strands of ideologies emerge, much like I would look on the world religions and hope, okay, let's hope for a more humanistic Islam or Buddhism or Catholicism than a less humanistic one. And even though I don't, say, belong to Islam, I can still hope for a more humanistic Islam and from within its own sources. And that's part of the point I'm trying to make. And I think some ideologies are going to have a much harder go at that. And so I feel sort of comfortable being hard on the white supremacists, because why not? But, but other ideologies, it's kind of epistemic humility. There's a provisionality. This is what really bothers me about, say, the post-liberals, is they think they have one version of liberalism that they slayed, and now it's a religion, it leads to degeneracy and atomization, and now done with that, we're post-liberal now. No, these are dynamic cultural traditions. There are many liberalisms. Yes, yeah, some of them are clunky in the way that you just managed to destroy with your philosophical arguments, but others aren't. So humble pie for all of us. Like, let's sit with the more complex, nuanced versions of the ideological traditions that face us.
Yeah, I think I'm with you. I mean, in the sense that, yeah, we're both humanists, and so tend to, I think, forgive the kind of internal tensions or criticisms that exist in political theories. I mean, in part because these are often generative, and in part because we are human beings ourselves, sort of complicated and contradictory. So when Burke or Rousseau, you encounter their texts, I mean, these are the sort of contradictions that exist in their texts are extremely generative and have a kind of positive thing to them. And they're contradictory in part because human beings are contradictory. Whereas the sort of the scientism concern, you know, the desire for objectivity is sort of, the bigger concern, I think, for the humanistic mind.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And it's almost, one way to put it is the hermeneutic approach to ideology is critical of all technocratic branches or wings of the ideologies. But then we have more complex provisional work left over with what's standing after that, you know, and then we can still do criticism, but I feel comfortable saying that we can sort of sweep off the table philosophically certain variants as just not persuasive anymore, not really live options. People might still inhabit them, but it's a little bit like looking over at astrology in that sense and being like, well, yeah, you can continue doing that. But yeah.
That's good. So let's start talking about some of these ideologies. You start with, there are three parts to the book, I should say. The first part mm-hmm. is about the sort of ideologies of founding of the U.S., you have a second part on contemporary ideologies, the left and the right, and then a third part on sort of hybridized ideologies that have emerged recently. So in the first part, you talk about classical liberalism, which is important. Yeah, the classical liberalism of John Locke emerged and developed, you know, influenced importantly the American founding. And then the sort of classical liberalism of Locke is a pretty familiar ideology. So I, you know, obviously not going to make you sort of run through the second treatise here, but if you want to, if there's anything sort of unfamiliar, I guess, about your reading that you want to sort of bring up, and, but you know, maybe you want to focus on kind of what the pressure points are that you see there in this ideology.
Yeah, I think that it's always sort of edifying to return to some of these, you know, these texts. But part of what was going on there is, as a hermeneuticist, I think the narrative account needs to locate itself somewhere. So, I am an American. I'm working in the United States. So it does start from within sort of the American scene, and then I hope in concentric circles sort of moves outward. And in the United States, it's for a long time, the basic thesis was that American ideology simply is liberal ideology. And part of what I try to do in the first chapters is uncover a multiplicity of Americas and of American foundings. And also to sort of show from the beginning, because I think Locke is sort of a test case for sort of, it, is ideology being sort of discovered out there in nature, or is it a cultural tradition that's being advanced? And I tend to think that Locke was sort of lost in ideology in the second treatise, insofar as he arrived in the Americas, and you know, he didn't arrive in the Americas, mentally arrived in the Americas, and sort of said, all the North American tribes are in my state of nature. They're proto-liberals, they're proto property holders. And I think it's a very dramatic moment in the history of liberal thought and political theory, because that had very real world consequences. And I talk about that in the book, that the mistaking in Borges's terms of, you know, cartography and geography, because he has that famous story of the map makers who try to make a map the size of the world. And that's one of my running metaphors in the book, is that with ideology, we tend to do that. And Locke to me is a very clear case, dramatic case, of someone who mistakes their map oftentimes for the world out there. And so then the assumption is, well, the natives in the Americas must also have individualistic property rights and so on. And that was a very fateful misreading or inability to exit one's own cultural tradition, because everywhere the colonists arrived, some were in bad faith, many were swindlers, but I really think there were some people who naively thought that the language of trade was simply universal and of private property. And I start out with that story about, you know, oh, they're trading in Manhattan for a few beads and pots and pans and things like that. Well, you know, our historians tell us that the indigenous tribes there didn't have a private conception of property rights. They probably thought that they were just offering Manhattan as a shared space for hunting and gathering for some period of time, not the permanent alienation of their land. So Locke is sort of this, you know, really clear case of someone who has a cultural map. It's quite complicated. It goes on to inspire other things. I don't mean to reduce Locke to this, but he's very clearly making the sort of what I call Borgesian mistake of building a map the size of the empire and then thinking the map is the empire. And so not being able to see the world out there, if that makes sense. And to great political effect, I try to suggest in the opener.
Yeah. And I mean, on this point, I mean, one of the questions I think I had with some of your readings of this is, like, you know, how much of the kind of pressure points exist in here because of the ideology itself, and how much exists because of the way the sort of, I guess, the ideology is applied to particular empirical mm-hmm. cases. So I guess what I have in mind with Locke is it might be the case that, you know, Locke develops this political theory and then, like, looks at America and applies his political theory wrongly, right? Even to, I mean, there are a couple of different ways you could go. You could say, well, like, look, Locke, you were wrong about the Native Americans. Like, they, even on your view, they're property holders because they mixed their whatever labor with the land. Or you could develop a different way and sort of balk back to Locke's sort of earlier statement about all the world is held in common among all human beings as a kind of, you know, basis for a kind of common, you know, collective form of property that would be instantiated in certain societies. So to sort of broaden out the political theory to sort of encompass. So in other words, I mean, I don't know if that's helpful, but to think, you know, because sometimes political theorists do this move where we sort of take the political theory and show that it can work in ways that the political theorist him or herself might not have expected.
A fair point. So, and well put. I guess what I would add there is the whole setup of, I'm very hostile to the notion of finding this sort of foundations of politics within a state of nature, because I think the state of nature is cultural or historical. And so something in that first move or thought experiment is very bewildering or foggy or confused as to what, how politics actually gets going. The paradox from the hermeneutic perspective is that the cultural is the natural, if you like. The natural situation of the anthropological is the cultural historical. So to go back into a supposed pre-political natural situation is simply to reproduce naively one's own politics or cultural or intuition. So I think that setup is wrong. On the other hand, on the positive side, what I try to do with Locke, I try to set him up for, there's another chapter on the dueling liberalisms, progressive versus right libertarian or neoliberal. And what I really, I try to show that Locke is already, in terms of an ethical source, in terms of a vision of what's good, he already has in him sentiments that are sort of pro-social or given toward equality in the state of nature, as well as the sort of individualism he's usually associated with. And one of the reasons I sort of work hard to do that is I try to show that the liberal tradition, a little bit like the way Christianity split into Protestants and, you know, Catholics, and the liberal tradition itself can look back to some of its inspiring texts and find in it meaning-making sources for its rival versions. Whereas I think oftentimes, one thing that sort of niggles me as a political theorist is you'll often hear people in the public square today say, well, I'm a classical liberal. No, I mean, that's a little bit like the move when someone says, well, I just believe in the Bible. You know, it's like, no, these are mediated. Catholics also believe in the Bible. You know, it's contested all the way down. And Locke, as positive or generative meaning maker for politics, offers a vision of politics that is quite complex, nuanced, and already contains within it tensions that later liberals will draw on to in differing directions. And so that's something else I try to do in the chapters. You know, Locke is actually a kind of incredibly creative articulator of political meaning, so much so that he generates a sort of even schism, or a schism is inspired by him, you know, a liberal schism. You know, this is not new to me by a long shot, but a liberalism of sentiments, you know, versus a liberalism of mere interests, which is part of how I narrate the later liberalisms, is progressives have, if you like, doubled down, enriched, and advanced a liberalism of the sentiments, and neoliberals and right libertarians have doubled down and radicalized and made much more complex and mathematized a liberalism of the interests. You know, that's another thing I'm trying to do in Locke, beyond just the critical aspect, is also, okay, but he also did something almost poetic, ethical, law giving, you know, in his articulation of a map or a vision.
Yeah, that's helpful. I will say the one thing I'll say about the state of nature is the, you know, I think it's a fair point to think of it as a, you know, you know, something that doesn't really exist anywhere. I think probably the state of nature thinkers mainly at the end of the day would probably agree with you that it's first and foremost a kind of thought experiment. But in any case, it does run afoul, I think, of the things that we've been talking about, this sort of way in which it becomes a kind of appeal to objectivity that stands outside of competing ideologies. But, you know, I mean, I think the kind of case for that appeal to some sort of perspective in nature is to have some sort of critical purchase on probably some pretty nasty stuff. I mean, Locke had aristocratic views of human inequality in mind. You have a chapter, the next chapter is in part on white supremacy, but you know, in part, you know, when you have conflicts over ideologies, one of the, I think the useful thing is to have some kind of, you know, it is tempting to have an appeal to some powerful view of nature as establishing human equality that can resolve this kind of conflict easily. I think it is tempting. But you still think that it's wrong-headed, though.
Yeah, it is, unfortunately. I mean, I wish I had something like that on hand too, you know. But And I should add that I think that in addition, the opening chapter, it sort of develops a major theme of the book, which is that if ideologies are forms of meaning making, interpretive and inside of history, they're also what I call liquid. And I think one of the reasons we're really lost in ideology is we don't see that the ideologies are really capable of fusionism and hybridization. And I say in the introduction that, you know, if I tell you, oh, there's fusion food and there's fusion music and there's cross-genre musicians that will like mix hip hop with heavy metal or country with, you know, R&B or whatever, everyone would nod and say, of course, and it doesn't have to be one or the other. Yeah, this taco is fusion with Korean and no problem. But when it comes to ideology, we really have trouble doing that for some reason, even though it's also a cultural phenomenon, maybe because of what you were just talking about, which is people seek to sort of exit their ideologies from the cultural historical sphere. But in the opener, what I try to show is, oh, well, in fact, these are incredibly porous, liquid, fusionist hybrids, even in the founding, because there is a sort of bleed across, say, like liberal Madisonianism into things like white supremacy. If you look at someone like Calhoun, who I treat at some length in the white supremacy chapter, or the very complicated relation between liberalism and civic republicanism, you know, classically articulated by Tocqueville. And so even in the founding moment, the sort of standard position for a long time that American ideology is just liberal needs to be sort of disaggregated and made more complex and nuanced precisely by saying, hey, ideologies are cultural maps that can have these features we don't expect. For instance, yeah, Locke can have a commitment to certain aristocratic values that's not how he's deployed typically ideologically, but they're there, right? And similarly, it's hard to understand the founding document of the United States in its totality without understanding something about white supremacy. If you look at the Three-Fifths Compromise, I mean, that just doesn't make sense within the exclusive vocabulary of liberalism. Clearly, a fusionist hybridization is going on there with white supremacy and its notions that some people aren't really fully agents or something like this. So, yeah, part of what I'm trying to do there is I think I take Malcolm X's quote, at least I'd meant to at one point when I was writing the book about we didn't land on Plymouth Rock, Plymouth Rock landed on us. And I try to say, look, ideology is like that. Ideology is liquid in that way. There are many Plymouth Rocks. There are many possible foundings and landing points on the continent. It's not just that there's the one Plymouth Rock that is a hard reified object there. Yes, there is the Plymouth Rock that is a rock, but in ideology, that thing is always liquid. You know, it's not just this one thing. And what part of what I was trying to say about the American founding, which has a certain fit with all the fighting going on right now about, you know, 1618 and what is the real founding, is there is contestation, liquidity, fusionism, tensions all the way back in the beginning. And the sort of Hartzian thesis, you know, Hartz's famous thesis that we're all liberals here, doesn't quite grasp it, you know, doesn't quite get the original situation in the United States. And the reason I'm so hard on Locke is I sort of see him doing that in a way. Maybe I'm not being totally fair with him, but with the natives and in particularly the indigenous tribes of the North is, well, they're already proto-liberal, which to me is a precursor, something someone like Hartz can look back at and say, see, this is the homeland of liberalism. This is the naturally liberal polity in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about Jefferson in the chapter on white supremacy as, you know, a useful figure here who kind of even more explicitly sort of brings out the, you know, inequality among Native Americans, African Americans, while also having the sort of Lockean liberal commitments. So I don't know if you want to sort of expand on that. I mean, you talk about the civic Republican element. Certainly it's familiar from Tocqueville, but if you want to say a little bit about the sort of white supremacy point and how that's sort of been intrinsic in the American experience.
Yeah, I would love to say a word on that because I think we're fighting about it a lot, because part of it is, how do we anchor our own narratives about the significance and meaning of the United States as a political project? And again, if I can harp on sort of our being lost in the maze of ideology, we want to sort of reify the founding into one thing. And we want to sort of give up on the need for an art of interpretation and to go back and see Jefferson isn't all one or the other. And neither are we, by the way. We all have complex ideological strains. Hybridization is really the rule of the day. You know, I mean, the idea of like the pure test case, you know, ideologically pure test case, maybe some philosophers really sort out their beliefs and consistently, but on the ground, most people have really fusionist views. And Jefferson is this case, very frustrating case of someone who can both write an incredibly inspiring set of documents from within the liberal tradition that are incredibly ethically magnetic, et cetera, and also have these completely, you know, vile views about race and racial caste. And his view was that, you know, or at least at one point, his view, which I discuss in the book, was that you needed separate republics, you know, so it was almost like a separate but equal writ large, like you would have a black republic, I think he speculated, in the Caribbean, and then you would have a sort of white republic, otherwise you would end in race wars, et cetera, et cetera. I actually think Calhoun got the upper hand in terms of the actual trajectory of political history, because I sort of narrate him as the founder of what's come to be called colorblind racism, where you basically take Madisonian rules, because Calhoun was quite a clever Madisonian, but the way I read him is he's in a bad faith. He basically is using Madisonian rules that appear colorblind to then generate, with this whole argument about concurrent majorities and so on, which I'm sure most listeners are very familiar with, but to actually generate a particular outcome that secures white majorities as a bloc in the South. But I think part of our fighting happens because we expect a kind of ideological purity that's not really true to life or true or reasonable to expect, because they're cultural. I mean, the same way that it would be sort of outrageous to ask, I don't know, a music group to just play pure rock and roll, whatever that would even be. I mean, you'd go back and find out rock and roll has jazz and blues and country mixed in. But yet we make this demand on ideology constantly that I don't think is a reasonable demand.
In the case of white supremacy, it seems to me that this is the kind of ideology in the Marxian sense, though, in the sense that it's a sort of appeal to some kind of bogus scientific authority in order to shore up power. I guess why am I wrong in thinking that?
I think that what I retain from the critical conception of ideology and what makes me so different than, say, mainstream political science is I'm not merely offering a descriptivism. I'm trying to offer a sort of ethnography of the neighbor, I say in the opener. And so there is a descriptive component to it. I'm trying to capture, you know, the tradition on its own terms, but it's always critical interpretive social science. So, yeah, when is ideology false? And so we retain this sort of critical edge. Well, whenever it thinks of itself as mere science or something like this. Yeah, I think white supremacy is a good test case for an ideological tradition that would struggle to be right by hermeneutic lights. I can imagine trying in some way someone to go back to traditions that are either cultural or theological, but it seems to really run against the grain of trying to make a natural type out of race. So I think it comes at a huge philosophical cost. Yeah, so I would basically concede in that case. Now, the problem is that then Marxism does that, or at least mainstream 20th century Marxism, I'd always say, does that from a perspective of, well, we have a predictive theory of history that is somehow outside of the ideological fray, and we'll get to a post-ideological age, which to me is then to repeat the mistake. So I'm trying to do something where I retain the critical edge without saying that there's exit, if you like, that we're still all engaged in this ideological tumult. And I think that at least Orthodox Marxism then reproduces the mistake by then saying, oh, well, there was exit, you know, and we have a predictive sociology of the end of liberalism or the end of capitalism.
I very much appreciate this part of your project, because I think, you know, in American politics writ large, sort of a polarized country, is very familiar. We're going to talk about polarization here in a second in your book, but it's often exacerbated by a sense of each side is sort of condescending to the other, or certainly this is often the sort of the right populist view of the left, that it's a sort of educated condescension to the right. And It's no surprise that that perception could be generated by a view that, well, we have scientific technocratic authority on our side and you're a basket of deplorables, right? So I very much appreciate that element, because that defangs that condescension. It's like, no, well, like, we're engaged in a hermeneutic circle with everyone. We're in fusion of horizons with everyone, not just the people we like. So I appreciate that part of your project. I mean, in the interest of time, sorry, because I don't want to get, but in the second part, you talk about the development of the left and the right in America. And we talked a little bit about the development of liberalism out of Locke. And you talk about the sort of progressive strain and FDR in practice and T.H. Green in theory. And then the sort of reaction, I think, in neoliberalism, Reagan and say in practice, and Hayek in theory. I don't know if you want to say anything, you know, in general about, you know, sort of any upshots there with the yeah. liberal tradition, thinking about it.
Just very briefly, upshots to be able to get to other stuff would be that I think that progressive liberalism gets lost in ideology when it thinks of history as a sort of developmental linear thing, akin to what I was just describing in Marxism, where everyone eventually becomes progressive. It becomes common sense. You just believe in science, or you believe in. But I think that progressive liberalism has tremendous resources in people like T.H. Green, who I don't see as subject to my criticism. Does it mean he's right and that's true ideology? No, it just means hermeneutical critique of T.H. Green would have to then move to immanent critique if one were to do that. But it's basically a live option from the hermeneutic perspective. Whereas on the neoliberal libertarian side, it's one of these ideologies I am harder on, because I think its main public form was premised on the notion that there was a sort of rational scientific organization of markets that was simply the only way that you could reasonably organize society. I'm much more sympathetic philosophically to Nozick, because Nozick has this weird position of like anarcho-libertarianism. Now, has it ever happened? I don't know, but he doesn't tend to go in like Milton Friedman or Hayek for sort of these technocratic forms. So yeah, I would just say upshot there is I try to do this sort of determinate negation, if you like Hegel, where like something is left over in the traditions, and then something is critically rejected in both of those. And there's probably more critical rejection on the neoliberal side, though there is still something that is remainder or left over in those traditions. And I think they're live traditions in that sense. And if I can just hammer away at that again, because I think the post-liberals are being so uncharitable hermeneutically to the liberal tradition writ large, there are many liberalisms, and the notion that you could just by one silver bullet kill an ideological tradition is just not very true to life. I mean, it'd be a little bit like saying I have the one argument that means you have to stop being Buddhist right now. I mean, that's just a whopper, and I don't buy it. And it bothers me that way of thinking is so pervasive right now. It doesn't mean you have to be a liberal. It just means you have to contend with the complexity and richness of the liberal tradition. You can't just say, I have this one argument. I see people like Vermeule or Dineen doing this. Why liberalism failed, you know? That'd be to me like saying, well, why Christianity failed, or why Islam failed? I mean, fine. But like, recognize the complexity of what you're positing. You can't just take one version and say it's done and dusted. So that's what I would want to take away from the liberal chapters.
Yeah, and just I guess in the interest of charity toward the neoliberal perspective, I mean, something you said was a little bit surprising, in the sense that from a sort of Hayekian perspective, to be accused of a kind of scientific technocracy, right, on the one hand, whereas the progressive liberalism is not prone to technocracy. Yeah. You know, it's obviously, as you know, I mean, very much in Hayek, the opposite, which is that the ills of a sort of progressive liberalism is that it assumes for itself a kind of air of scientific authority and ability to predict markets and so forth. One of the benefits of a kind of form of neoliberalism, he didn't call himself a neoliberal, but the benefit of that form of liberalism, which would back away from kind of technocratic authority, which would be to point towards some kind of spontaneous order, which is, I assume, kind of congenial to a hermeneutic project, in the sense that it would involve letting a thousand flowers bloom and not sort of clamping down on any one of them, not tending the garden, right, but allowing them to bloom.
I mean, so I've gotten blowback in various ways. So I wrote a piece for Harper's Magazine on sort of technocratic progressive liberalism around the pandemic. And that, so there it would have sounded like what you're saying, you know. So I do develop in other places and in the book critiques of technocratic progressive liberalism. And I have received blowback from Hayekians on, hey, our guy is the anti-scientism guy. The reason I'm so hard on Hayek is because the whole road to serfdom thing, you know, to me makes the same mistake as Marxism in a different way. You know, it's like, you can't say that social democracy or social liberalism is going to take you to totalitarianism in a certain amount of time without assuming a sort of mechanistic causal sequence to regimes that to me is just a form of scientism and has been proven false by the actual record. I mean, how long can you have a social democracy for without the emergence of totalitarianism, say in Western Europe or in the United States post-New Deal? So that's where Hayek to me makes the same mistake. There are also questions around, is a spontaneous order ever itself really spontaneous, or is it within a particular cultural tradition and so on? So that's why sort of, to me, Nozick doesn't, and I could be corrected here, but I don't see Nozick making these kind of developmental arguments about regimes having to follow in sequence, which I think is a mistake on Hayek's part. It would be a case of sort of scientism for me in politics. But I have had many Hayekians tell me, wait, how could you be so critical of our guy? He's precisely against scientism in economics. So fair enough, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is another case in which it's, you know, the epigonies of the original thinkers are sort of more prone to these ideological ills than than the original figures, right? I mean, sort of the Milton Friedmans or the other sort of followers in the broad Hayekian tradition certainly would appeal much more to, you know, just look what economic science has to say about human behavior and the way markets work. Ergo, this is how we should structure our society. Or, you know, economics says that minimum wage doesn't work, so we should can it or whatever. So, you know, I mean, that kind of appeal to social science versus sort of social science scientism would be sort of much more prone to a follower of Hayek, though maybe not himself. I don't know if you have anything to say about the sort of, yeah, the original figure. I mean, there's, I think, you know, a nice thing about going back to the original thinkers to sort of rejuvenate the ideology.
It's very perceptive of you, because one of the ways in which I think that hermeneutics can generate criticism is by correction to the most articulate variant, which is how I use these sort of incredibly classical figures within the different ideological traditions. Is so if you have a certain version of ideology that's not as articulate or defensible, you can be corrected within your own tradition back to the better variant. So it's another way to sort of generate traction or objectivity within hermeneutics. So that would be fair game for me, that move you're making. And then we'd have to get into the argument about what's in Hayek, what does it say, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that that's a good way, because part of what's going on at the meta level in the book is, what are good and bad ways to argue about ideology? Bad ways are like, it's just nature, it's just common sense, it's just science. That's a good way to me, what you're signaling there. And then we'd have to get into the thicket of debate over Hayek himself, what he says, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that's a good way to debate ideology. If you're across someone who doesn't share your ideological tradition, it's good to be informed and multilingual in their classical figures so that you can evoke in an intelligent way their own authorities for them, you know, and potentially correct them epistemically to some other version of their own position. Yeah.
That's good. We have a bunch of ideologies left. So I have to sort of... although I don't know if I want to make the choice of which to axe and which not. I mean, if you, what do you want to talk about more? You want to talk about conservatism, fascism, socialism?
Well, I can say very quickly about socialism, because I feel like I've been a little too hard on the Marxian variants, but I actually think that socialism is also a live option through more cultural, ethical versions. So I'll say that for any listeners who are attracted to socialism or participate in the socialist political tradition, that I think socialism has live options. And the idea that I'm also hostile to the idea, well, Marxism failed in the 20th century, therefore thou shalt never speak of socialism again, I don't think that's intellectually honest. And so I talk about the many different variants of socialism within the tradition, and also that what are still live themes that come out of the Marxist map. But actually, you know, the one I'd like to sort of talk about is fascism, because it's one of these cases where I think that the hermeneutic approach to ideology as a concept can help us with some of the befuddlement that's going on very immediately right now, because there's this huge fascism debate going on in the public square of, did it happen here? Can it happen here? And I think one of the things that this debate gets wrong is actually philosophical. It's usually argued historically. Like, people will go back and say, look, here's the features of the classic cases of fascism that no one denies are fascism, like Mussolini, who invented the term, and here's what it looked like, or Hitler, and here's what his regime looked like. And so then you have people who are arguing over, and not wrongly, but, you know, the history of the classical cases of those regimes. And then, of course, the argument is over MAGA. Does MAGA have fascist elements, or does the new right in the United States have fascist elements, and what are they? And I think that hermeneutics helps here precisely because the search for sort of a litmus test, what is often called a fascist minimum, I think is a bit of a fool's errand philosophically. Instead, what we have are cultural traditions. So the question is, are there themes, beliefs, meanings, resonances subject to contestation, but that emerge within the new right? It's not a all or nothing test case. So the fascism chapter, I think, speaks to something very immediate right now. And I'm trying to do something in that chapter that is very typical of the whole book, which is maybe our hermeneutic concept can help us here overcome certain pseudo debates that we have, or pseudo problems that we have around ideology.
Yeah, this is helpful. I mean, because one of the things I think I'm curious about with your view of ideology is, you know, we're familiar, I think, with sort of more and less extreme versions. You know, they're like we call them ideologues, you know, and they're sort of extremely dogmatic. And then there are, you know, I don't know, it's like turning a dial. It's like a quantitative way of thinking about ideology. People who are just sort of either less committed or, you know, more indifferent to the views. I guess that's how I think about these sort of fascist minimum and thinking about the ways in which sort of ideologies can have more or less. I mean, one of the things I hear you discussing ideologies in a sort of qualitative humanistic terms. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you see this sort of quantitative, there are value to kind of quantitative analysis to these things?
It depends what we're doing with quantification. I'm actually not against, you know, using statistics in interpretive research. I have a book with Mark Beaver called Interpretive Social Science for any listeners who would be interested in a deeper dive there as to what's the role between interpretive and hermeneutic approaches to social science and the different methods. Because I do think there's a role for, say, you know, gathering statistics on a particular ideology or political culture and finding out, for instance, you know, how many firearms do Americans own? I mean, that's a useful question to ask. And I don't know how the heck you're going to ask it of 300 million people without the use of statistics and quantification and so on. So, however, in the case of fascism, I mean, I'd want to know what we're doing with quantification. If we're searching for a fascist minimum as in an ahistorical core set of features that have to be there at all times and places for a regime to kind of have a litmus test of fascist positive or fascist negative, then I am critical of this, because hermeneutics has an anti-essentialist conception of ideological traditions. So, and if I can say something more practical here, I think one of the reasons Americans, myself, I don't exclude myself from this, or you could even say Westerners right now, are so confused, anxious about politics is because we are actually living through a period of tremendous ideological innovation and change. And so some of the old categories feel inadequate at the same time that they seem present very heavily. And so if you take the case of fascism, I just think that what we have in the United States is probably some kind of hybridization with some fascist themes and some neoliberal ones. So whereas classical fascism had a kind of militarist front, we have some of that in the United States, paramilitarizing, you know, if you think of some of these like Proud Boys and so on, making the friend-enemy distinction legible in public, all that. But the what we have, in fact, as the main form is a kind of hybridization of ultranationalist reaction with more familiar neoliberal forms in the United States. So like the business suit, the CEO who says you're fired as a kind of figure of authority that has some resonances with fascism, but it's not the same as the wearing of military fatigues. It doesn't come out of militarist culture. It comes out of neoliberal CEO culture and the boss having the say over everything, organizing the entirety of the polity, like along the lines of a very hierarchical top-down, you're fired sort of structure. So I think, you know, if we don't have interpretive and cultural sensitivity to the way that ideologies can suddenly mutate and change within their traditions, then something happens, to take an analogy with religion again, because I think there are similarities between religions and ideologies. A Martin Luther appears, or some great innovator within a religious tradition, and then everyone is sort of lost for a while because they don't know how to place or think about the mutation in the traditions that's going on. And I think that's part of the perplexity right now, is people are expecting the same things to happen in the same ways or not to happen at all. But new things are happening. Cultural innovation is happening. And, you know, you and I think both grew up the same time period. There was so much stagnation around the polarization of the Cold War that it seemed like the world would never change. And part of what's so confusing and anxious right now is everything is changing so fast. My term for this is that ideologies are liquid, you know, and fascism is one of these cases where it's not all or nothing. You know, it's like with fusion food, you can have a little fascism mixed in with your neoliberalism or your, you know what I mean? It doesn't have to be. And I think the argument is very clunky. It's either we see Hitler in the camps or there's no fascism in this society. And I'm very critical of that, because now then we can contest it. We can argue over it, et cetera. But I don't know if that's helpful, Jeffrey. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really helpful. It's very persuasive in a way, because I like this idea of the sort of hybridization that Trump represents, right? Because it's useful for a couple of reasons. I mean, one is that it helps explain to me why Republicans would pick him over, say, somebody like Nikki Haley, right? If the guy is a sort of hybridization of not just, you know, fascism, but a number of other kind of, you know, neoliberal and sort of more traditional conservatives. So he's able to sort of unite coalitions. So like business conservatives, why in the hell, why would you vote for this guy? Well, because they might hold a nose up at the sort of fascist elements, but the neoliberal. But it also helps, I think, and it's really useful for thinking about sort of his governing manner. I mean, we saw this from 2016 to 2020, that there's a way in which the different kind of hybrid ideologies were in tension with one another. And so is this Trump talk, we're talking about tax cuts and sort of neoliberal approach, or is this Trump, this sort of like destroying trade, you know, treaties and so mm-hmm. forth, and sort of anti-neoliberal. And that, you know, it helps make sense of this age where you have these sort of competing ideologies that are all swirling together. So I do appreciate that element.
And I think we theorists are sometimes behind the innovation, because there is a sort of small d democratic feature to the hermeneutic view of ideologies, which is, well, on the one hand, you can correct to sort of classical articulations, but they really are the works of many hands and many minds and many interpreters. I mean, even some of the nasty, gross, stupid, inane, ephemeral stuff that happens online, it is also a space of sort of foment and creativity right now. And new variants and mutations are happening through those modes, much like Luther with the printing press. You know, I do think we're living through a time of, why is online so vexing and attractive and gross at the same time? Well, it's incredibly dynamic what's happening there. Which of these will be, you know, surviving strains or mutations or not, I have no idea. And it could be that a great theorist or philosopher comes along and gives a more crystallized articulation. Maybe something people find very galling, I've certainly had public debates with him about, Adrian Vermeule, is he's smart enough to give a kind of new rationalization to the constellation of stuff that's going on that might have more enduring value or not, or a Patrick Deneen or someone like that, who is a kind of theorist. But I think we're kind of, for better or worse, have a front row seat to ideological innovation right now, for better or worse. Whereas in the 80s and 90s, I always tell my students, what were the 90s like? The 90s were like, nothing will change. Some people were happy. Some people were sad. Call that grunge music. Some people were indifferent, but it was, it felt like the world would never change ideologically.
Yeah, you know? the end of history, right?
Yeah, the end of history, exactly. Whereas now, I mean, yeah, it just feels very, what is it? I love the line in Shakespeare and Richard III, it's a reeling world. I think Catesby says that. It's a reeling world. You know, it is a reeling world we're living in right now.
Let's talk about the, I know this is skipping up a couple chapters, apologies, but I didn't want to quit before talking about the chapter on eco-politics. So, you know, this is in the third part where you're talking about, again, the pickup on this theme of this sort of hybridization of ideologies that's going on in the contemporary world that causes a lot of confusion. You talk here about nationalism, multiculturalism, feminism, and which have sort of been mutating and entangling themselves with other ideologies. You talk about eco-politics, which is a really, really important issue these days. And this is a big camp. I mean, many different kind of approaches to this ideology. Maybe you can kind of give us your own map of their map.
Yeah. Well, I don't have a good replacement metaphor for the spectrum where you have kind of intervals right across a spectrum from left to right. But at the end of the book, one of the ongoing agendas at the end of the book is to complicate that picture, because we tend to think, mostly due to the inheritance of the counterculture and its popularization of certain themes, Rousseauian themes, themes from transcendentalism, and so on, that ecologism is a left ideology. And that's just not true, you know? So part of what I'm trying to show is, due to these features of hybridization and so on, you know, you have longstanding forms of the tradition we were just talking about, eco-fascism, where, you know, the white race or the Aryans see themselves in the black forests of Germany or whatever it is, and they should preserve it. Yeah, you have industrialized strains of fascism too. There's a lot going on. But, and then you have eco-capitalisms, eco-socialisms, eco-nationalisms, eco-feminisms. And so part of what I'm trying to show there is, you know, we have this left-right picture, and I don't have a good replacement for it, though. I float at one point in the book that a Jackson Pollock painting would be probably a better picture of what really happens with ideologies, which is left can hybridize with right. And part of the problem with the spectrum is we think, well, since left is over here, you couldn't possibly have, say, like socialism melding with conservatism, because in between it is liberalism. But they do meld, you know. Think of someone like William Morris, and so part of what I'm trying to do is sort of show, hey, you know, all the ideologies are what scholars call cross-cutting. But once we see that, even if we don't have a good replacement language, we have to use this language a little carefully, because it can mystify us into not seeing what's in front of our own faces. And a sad thing for me, this is a little bit of prognosis in the book, is I sort of think one of the more likely futures is a kind of eco-nationalism, maybe even eco-fascism, where the reality of the environmental catastrophe becomes so undeniable that instead of simply saying, well, it doesn't exist, what you have is sort of shoring up of borders, an attempt to not have, you know, eco refugees coming into the state, and a kind of authoritarian emergency, a Schmidtian sort of emergency over the eco catastrophe. But there are other possible eco futures. But I mean, something I'm sort of kicking around, and I hope for other eco futures where we find through creative innovation new ways of retaining a more humanistic politics that also recognizes sort of the ecological crisis. But I think what I'm trying to sort of show there is that as the ecological catastrophe becomes sort of more and more undeniable as a feature of nature outside of our political maps, then the different maps are going to have to adjust. The traditions are going to have dilemmas, basically, and you're going to have responses from within those traditions, like it or not, that are eco-variant responses to the crisis.
Yeah, that's good. I think one of the questions that I had about this chapter was, it seems like an exception in that it is an appeal to nature. I mean, and that is that there's a power outside of hermeneutics that we are responsive to. Like, not, it's not, climate catastrophe is not a cultural creation, right? It's actually a natural fact and something. So it's interesting that you conclude with this. That is that, you know, there's, you know, much of what you've been discussing throughout is a kind of, well, if, you know, if we engage in a kind of hermeneutic activity and deepen our historical understanding, but here actually there's a way in which there's a kind of a scientific authoritativeness to this ideology. Am I wrong in seeing that? And what do you think that stands in tension with the rest of your view?
No, I mean, that is, again, very, very perceptive read. I appreciate that, because I really am sort of having a quarrel with myself there over the, I think I call it the meaning of the earth. And something romanticism brought to the fore for us culturally is the notion that nature might have meanings and is within hermeneutics, in the sense of there's the question of what's the significance of nature. Is nature just an instrumental set of goods? Like, you know, just, you know, when you look at a forest, you just see lumber, and that interpretation or that set of meanings itself has political ramifications. Or does it have intrinsic value, almost spiritual value, a value of sort of being in communion with something outside of yourself? And one thing I find fascinating about ecological politics is it's at the borderlands in a really interesting, unresolved way between nature and culture. Though for me, it's always universal hermeneutics for the human situation. And one thing I would throw in there to make it more complex is, so my prior book that we talked about, We Built Reality, I talk a lot about double H effects and the way that our descriptions actually are world-making. And something like that is going on throughout this book as well. And a really weird thing about ecology is that it's actually culture interpenetrating nature. So if I have a very instrumental view of nature, I actually can generate an ecological crisis. If I just treat nature, the meaning of nature, as a bucket of stuff that I control, then it seems like nature can have blowback and come back at me, or there's a consequence in nature to my cultural stance. So there's a kind of porousness there. I really like the phenomenologist Hartmut Rosa, who's working in Germany on issues of like controllability and non-controllability. And I cite him in this chapter, but I think there's some real unresolved issues there around what's my interpretive grid, or how does nature show up for me as meanings, and how does politics porously enter into nature? And so my label for this set of problems right now is the meaning of the earth. Like, what's the meaning of the earth? And I have some stuff to say about that, but am puzzled by it myself. I think we're all sort of living through a kind of puzzlement about it, because the typical view of nature that it's just sort of out there and dead objects that I can control, this is Hartmut Rosa, actually leads to uncontrollability. It seems like that's one thing we're learning here, is the ideologies of technocratic control over nature actually have led to uncontrollability over nature. Nature comes back all the more uncontrollable. So what do we do? Do we double down ecologically on, you know, sort of ecotechnologies saving us? Or is there something in that very interpretive grid that is unstable, right? Which is the position of, say, deep ecologists or eco-socialists or conservative pastoralists, that, you know, you have to let something be in nature to have a healthy relationship to. You have to have something uncontrollable in nature, call it wilderness, in order to have a healthier relationship to it. So anyway, yeah, you very perceptively saw there, I think you're the first person to have flagged that I've spoken to so far, that there is, that's at the borderlands of the whole project. I feel like eco politics really throws into question or relief some of the big issues around hermeneutics and a cultural approach to ideology.
Yeah. This leads to my last question. We can conclude with this, because it's what you say about humanity's relationship to nature, I find endlessly fascinating on this topic, because it, one of the ways I teach, I didn't mention this yet, but I teach I have taught a class on left, right, and center, and sort of about the traditions of the left and right, which is in part what you're doing in the book here. But, you know, one of the ways that I tend to teach it and think about it is that, you know, some of the ways that we can think about the difference between the left and the right is about, you know, views of human nature and humanity's relationship to nature. That is that, you know, typically conservatives tend to be much more pessimistic about our capacity for self-transformation and tend to think of human nature as kind of sinful and unfixed. And so we have to relate to it in that way. Whereas progressives tend to be much more open to the possibility that humanity can be perfected and transformed and government can have a role in that and so forth. It's interesting to hear this sort of eco version of that, which again upends some of these categories that I've been thinking about. It that is that an eco left actually might not think that. That is, that might bring in nature once again to say no, that like I think a lot of conservatives do, which is no, nature is actually sort of a limit for human possibility that we must respect and that we can't transcend. I don't know if that, you know, you have any sort of concluding words about the left and the right, and if this sort of appeal to how we think about nature and human nature is useful.
No, it's a great point. And I think that it's one of these cases where there's a major scramble going on, because you can find left variants that let nature be and right variants that let nature be. I usually narrate eco-pastoralism as via someone like J.R. Tolkien, because he has such a nostalgic medievalist view of nature. And yet my father, who was a progressive on a part of the counterculture and things like that, he read me Tolkien growing up, not realizing he was reading me crypto-Catholicism, because he just, that view of nature really resonated with the sort of social liberal left at that time. At the same time, you have versions of the left and the right that are more sort of, you could call them like techno-utopian or more optimistic about being able to get a grip on nature, right? That sort of see technology as having the ultimate role in sort of resolving the problem of nature, you know, whether it be like colonies on Mars or Teslas or something like this. So it's one of these cases where there can be really strange bedfellows politically on both sides, you know. The bewilderment around someone like Elon Musk, who has anyone changed more rapidly from sort of left friendly to right friendly? I mean, it was a matter of years where my friends who loved Elon Musk because he was doing exciting, good things, you know, these are sort of center left liberals, to, oh my goodness, like he's on the right, he's on the, you know, but why? I mean, even on the question of ecology and the environment, he's one of these figures who is, he seems to have a position about controllability of nature that can have cross resonances, if you see what I'm saying. So yes, I think it's one of these cases where it's quite scrambled and something new might be emerging in terms of the political traditions around the set of problems that we face. And the possibility of different new realignments where eco-socialists are actually closer to conservative pastoralists. And then the sort of tech booster option, it has certain mixing going on that didn't go on before around that issue.
Well, Jason, this has been so much fun. So thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Really appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.